I think we've had the sort of era of plant-based, and you can see what's happened with all these kind of fake meat companies that have gone on, Beyond Meat, Impossible Burger, Corn. All these companies are failing because no one's buying it. And they certainly don't want the ultra-processed crap. And then even the fake meat, lab meats that these startups are coming, they're really struggling now. They're really finding that, hey, they're not paying off. The Silicon Valley guys that have invested tens of billions of dollars in these companies, they're not getting their money out of it.
Hello, critical thinkers. Welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Here, we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, board-certified health coach and founder of Avantia Health Optimization. Today, we're talking with someone who I really admire. He's a really cool dude, and he preaches the carnivore diet. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him and a little bit about what we talk about in the episode. But first, to set the scene, a lot of you, if you follow me on social media, you might know that I've recently been doing the carnivore diet after I developed some health issues. So I had some gut issues for years that started to turn into skin issues. At least I believe that those are connected. And I was kind of desperate because I tried everything. And nothing really worked. And if it did, it eventually, the skin and gut issues came back. And so I started hearing about this carnivore diet, and I was very skeptical. Even as somebody who's eaten steak a lot and always loved steak, I thought, you know, based on the research out there, based on what you hear, my health would get worse if I did the carnivore diet. And through my experience, I found out that I got a lot better. All the problems I was trying to address went away. No gut issues, no skin issues. I lost weight. I had more energy. I felt more clear-headed. So, I mean, I was astonished. And I wanted to explore this further. So I invited Dr. Sean Baker onto the show. And I'll tell you a little bit about him now. So he's the author of a best-selling book, The Carnivore Diet, which I highly recommend, especially if you're skeptical. I think you'll be shocked at some of what you find in there. But he's also an orthopedic surgeon with a military background. He served as a combat trauma surgeon in the Air Force. He has over 20 years of medical experience as an orthopedic surgeon. He's obviously known for promoting the carnivore diet, simple meat-based nutrition. He's also a well-accomplished athlete. He's a former world record holder in indoor rowing for his age group. He's also a competitive strength athlete lifting weights. I mean, he crushes it. He excels in not only weights and rowing, but also rugby and other sports. And he's in his 50s. He hosts the Rivero Health Platform, which supports people in adopting a carnivore diet. He's also a vocal critic of plant-based and vegan diets, and he also strongly opposes dietary guidelines pushed by the government. So basically, he challenges the status quo, which is what we are all about here on the Healthy and Awake podcast. So we do talk about all kinds of things, and I'll tell you, I actually come from a very skeptical point of view in this episode, perhaps more than any other guest. I'm playing devil's advocate here and challenging a lot of his beliefs, even though I've experienced the benefits. And we just cover so much in this episode. I think you're really going to love it. So without further ado, here we go. Dr. Sean Baker, thank you so much for being here. I've been a huge fan of yours for a while. I have your book right here, The Carnivore Diet by Dr. Sean Baker, MD. I've been really studying and prepping for this conversation by not only reading and listening to your podcast, but also, perhaps most importantly, eating plenty of steaks. I've been doing the carnivore diet myself. I feel better than ever. But I'm a board certified health coach, and we're kind of nudged into sharing the benefits of a plant-based diet that is actively pushed on us to push on other people. And to be fair, there is a lot of research on the benefits as far as I can tell. And I've even heard some pretty strong cases for a plant-based diet from people like Dr. Joel Kahn, who I believe is a friend of yours. So as a health coach who's been trained this way, how can I present the best information to the people I work with? Because it is kind of different from what's been out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. There's been a lot of research on plant-based diets. I mean, there's a lot of money that's been into that going at it, because we often lament the fact that we don't have a lot of data. Most of the health data is based on drug interventions because the drug companies can afford to run these big interventional trials. And so that's where we mostly go. So anybody who's talking lifestyle is kind of seen as kind of fringe and obscure, and there's not a lot of funding in that. Hats off to the Adventist Health System, the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. They've poured millions of dollars in research, and so they can point to that and say, look, we've got this research. On this carnivore side of the equation, we don't have that yet. This is sort of an emerging sort of thing. Now, fortunately, more and more people are taking this. We've had a few studies. We've had some case series. We've had some observational studies done that all have been positive up to this point. And now we're getting to the point where some of these interventional trials are starting to evolve, and I'm behind the scenes trying to make those things happen, because I'm not here just to sell books and be on social media. I'm actually interested in the science as a physician of helping people, because I've objectively seen, gosh, thousands upon thousands of people improve their health dramatically. I mean, I just literally did a consultation with a guy with Crohn's disease since he was 12. He's now 25, been on carnivore for a few months, complete resolution, gone all the symptoms after being on years of biologics and so on and so forth. And we have a case series written up that Nick Norwich and Adrian Sotomayor of Harvard have published back in September. So you are right in the fact that you're going to have a hard time to say there's a plethora of scientific research on this particular diet. And so if that's the criteria you want to use, and then I don't think I can help you yet. Maybe talk to me in 10 years when we've got a chance to study this more. And I absolutely think we should study this, as opposed to guys like Chris Gardner at Stanford saying it's unethical to study this diet. And I think that's nonsense. I think right now there are hundreds of thousands of people that have adopted this style of eating, for good or bad. And I think we do need to study that. So that's coming. Now, as far as, well, let's talk about the benefits of a plant-based diet. I mean, I think there are certain benefits that, I guess it depends upon what your comparator group is. Because if you go on a whole food plant-based diet, or even maybe a flexitarian diet, you're going to clearly do better than the standard Western diet. I mean, that's a low bar to clear. And I think, like, when it comes to things like weight loss, for instance, why would a plant-based diet help with weight loss? Well, I think the primary mechanism by which that occurs is by the consumption of, well, what are you replacing? So if you're replacing sugary junk and high fat foods with plants, you're going to see generally a benefit. But I think it's interesting. I get every time I say this, every few months I do this just for fun, maybe to annoy and piss people off. But I'll say that fiber is kind of overrated, right? Because we think, oh, fiber is a magic panacea. Everything's just shove more fiber in there. And I see quite the opposite in many cases, particularly with gut issues. People remove fiber and their gut gets better. But when we think about what is fiber doing or what is it not doing, fiber, let's say you replace a cookie with a sprig of broccoli. Yeah. I mean, you're going to take the cookie out, which is probably arguably a good thing. Although some people that like cookies may not agree with that, but it sort of prevents the absorption of nutrition in many ways. I mean, you think about it, fiber prevents the absorption of certain minerals and electrolytes. There's actually studies out there that show that a high fiber diet, when we examine the feces, what we poop out, the fiber has much more protein, carbs, and fat still in the feces, which means it didn't get absorbed. And so what happens is, if we go back to, like, why do we eat? What is the purpose of me eating? Well, presumably it's so I can get some nutrition, right? I mean, that's why you would assume. And you know, you think about what do we require? Well, we require these essential amino acids. There are essential fats. Energy, we need energy, right? So we can get it from carbs or fat. We need vitamins and minerals, and we need arguably water, right? I mean, this is why we consume things, right? And when we're eating fiber, a lot of fiber or organic fruits and vegetables, a lot of that fiber just interferes with the absorption of a lot of that nutrition. And so what happens is you have bigger bowel movements, you go to the bathroom more often. A lot of that nutrition ends up in the toilet, which I think, particularly in this economy with the prices of food, you don't want to be crapping on a lot of your nutrition. So it becomes an efficiency thing. And if we look at, like, all of the species of animals that live on planet Earth, that have ever lived on planet Earth for that matter, and we look at them and we count out, like, all the numbers of species there are, the vast majority of them have chosen a carnivorous strategy for nutrition because it's more efficient. It's easier, right? It's just, you think about it, I'm made of a bunch of animal cells. I mean, that's what I'm made of. And whether it's bone or cartilage or skin or hair or blood, it's all animal cells. And they have certain phospholipid phospholipid bilayer membranes. We don't have cellulose. We don't have cell walls like a plant. And so, like I said, if I were to build a brick house and I was like, hey, let's go build a brick house, it'd be nice if I had bricks, right? I could have straw and mud, and that would be a little more inefficient. I could cobble it together. So that's the difference, I think, is that an animal-based diet is more aligned with what we actually need. I mean, it seems to be a strange coincidence. The essential amino acids that we require for life are found in the exact concentration we need them in meat. It's like, is that is that coincidence perhaps? Or maybe it's because there's as part of that design. So I think clearly humans are meat eaters. I think it's fair to say we're omnivorous, but I think saying we are purely herbivores is a stretch. I think you can even say that with carnivores. I think I would say maybe we're facultative carnivores. Maybe we thrive on meat, which I think we do. I think it's a very easy strategy. We do have some capacity to digest and not to, I wouldn't say digest, to ferment plant material. I mean, when you compare it across different species, humans have like if you look at a chimpanzee has about a 50% capacity, like 50% of their gut anatomy is dedicated to fiber fermentation. So they can extract a lot more nutrition out of that. Humans have about a 15-16% of our gut hardware is dedicated to fermentation. Now that's exactly what a cat or a dog might have. Cats and dogs have about 15% of their gut is developed for fermentation. Now, what do cats and dogs eat? Or wolves, I guess, for that matter. Dogs are effectively wolves. They eat pretty much a carnivorous diet. I mean, they might have, like a dog, you might say, well, sometimes they nibble on a blade of grass, or maybe if they're eating a carcass, they might get some inadvertent plants in the stomach contents or intestinal contents. But for all intents and purposes, these are highly carnivorous animals, and cats are obligate carnivores because if they don't have taurine, they die. There's other things like that. Well, I mean, humans, you can make that argument with humans. If we don't have B12, guess what happens? We die. And the only place you get B12 essentially is through meat. Now, some people argue, well, you get it in like dirty vegetables, and you're assuming, you know, like people are eating human feces covered vegetables, what we would have eaten in the past. I would argue that's a little bit of a stretch. But so anyway, I think that, again, it's your comparator group. Plant-based diets, whole food plant-based diets are going to beat the standard American diet for sure. I think, well, arguably, depending on what's in there. I mean, we see plant-based diets leading to higher rates of mental health disorders, higher rates of bone mineral issues where fractures occurs. I see a lot of clinical issues with gut problems with that. So at the end of the day, you can use a lot of sources for your information. We can say, well, there's one true source. Everything should come through like the USDA or something like that. Where's your source of information coming from? And I think you sometimes run into problems with that. We saw that during, I think, COVID. I think that was fair to say. And I think that a lot of those guys got it wrong in many ways. And some other people were dissenting and they were largely censored and so on and so forth. So I think with nutrition, the nice thing about nutrition, like we can talk about like politics or climate change or whatever. And it's hard for me to independently verify anything. I can't walk outside and say, oh yeah, the climate's changed. I can't do that. I have no way of actually accurately as an individual. But what I can do, and I can sort of objectively say if I'm healthier, I know when my knee hurts, I know when my back hurts, I know when I'm fat, I know when I'm tired. And so you can objectively sort of evaluate these things. So that's a nice thing. So you do whatever you want. I don't care what people eat. I'd like some people to try carnivore if they're sick, because I think it can be effective. But, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, don't outsource your health or your nutrition to someone else. Don't let someone else to sort of decide what you do. You've got to objectively do this. And I think if you take the time and effort to because you have skin in the game. I mean, I talk to a lot of sick patients. They live with their diseases 24/7. Somebody has Crohn's disease. I don't have Crohn's disease. I don't live with that stuff. I don't have to face the consequences of what my recommendations are. So you've got to just say, okay, this is going to affect me pretty significantly. Let me objectively assess that stuff. But you can read papers. I mean, I can show you papers that'll support anything. I mean, you can find papers to support any position, quite honestly. So at the end of the day, it's like, you got to check this out yourself and be objective. And what counts to you? What are you trying to achieve? And if a plant-based diet makes you feel great, go for it. I don't care. If a carnivore diet makes you feel great too, go for it. I think that's fine too. I mean, that's my expertise. So that's what I talk about. But I'm the first one to admit that there are other ways to get healthy. I don't know if a carnivore diet is going to make me live longer or shorter, or cause me to get disease or prevent me from getting disease. I don't think that's knowable for really any diet, to be honest. So if we're really being honest here, I know there's people who will say, oh, I'm going to eat this way because it's going to make me live to be 120. Grain of salt with that stuff, because I don't think anybody knows that really.
Yeah. Well, I think you make a very strong case for the carnivore diet. And when I discovered it, I was pretty skeptical. And that's even I've always been a steak lover. Some of my fondest memories are with my dad on my 16th birthday. He took me out to get the biggest steak on the menu, and it was like falling off the plate. It was so big. And I started the carnivore diet because I was having these gut issues that turned into some pretty severe skin issues. I tried everything, and I couldn't believe it, but they went away after maybe 2 months of doing the carnivore diet. Everything went away, plus stuff I didn't even know, like realize that was going on. And then I was sold. But, you know, when people hear some of what you said, You sound very reasonable, but I do still hear a lot of like, well, meat can cause cancer from institutions, or cooking meat can, the advanced glycation end products and the HCAs and TMAO and all these different things. And Dr. Joel Kahn says pesticides can be on the meat, in the meat. And so to what extent is meat potentially harmful?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot to unpack there. So obviously, like 2015, the World Health Organization via something called the IARC, the International Association for Research on Cancer in Lyon, France, declared that red meat was a class 2 carcinogen, processed meat was a class 1 carcinogen, right? So that came out in 2015. That declaration was not unanimous. There was a whole bunch of people on that panel. It's like a 22-person panel, and about a third to 40% of the people were like, no, this is not right. David Clearfield, who's at Indiana University's professor, he said that was the most horrendous experience of his entire academic career, because they just rammed everything through. They ignored all the data that would dispute that finding. 30% of the panelists were vegetarian, vegan, ethical vegans, Seventh-day Adventists. They didn't declare any of those conflicts of interest. So you have that, you know, and of course you look at the funding source. Bill Gates funds the World Health Organization more than anyone else on the planet as an individual. He has obviously financial conflicts of interest with that, so it would benefit him to sort of disparage meat in that way. But I mean, even if you take it at face value and you look at that, they said, well, eating meat versus less meat increases your risk for colorectal cancer by 17% relative risk, right? And so we say, well, okay, well, relative risk, what does that mean in absolute terms? Well, the likelihood of you developing colorectal cancer, just a general generic person, is around 4%, right? It's not nothing, and 4% is not nothing. But that increasing that by 17% now takes it from 4% to 5%. So you have a 96% chance of not developing colorectal cancer if you don't eat meat, and now you have a 95% of not developing colorectal cancer in that way. So the magnitude of effect is actually quite small, even if you totally take their conclusions at face value. Now, since that time, there have been a number of studies. Washington University back in 2022 basically said, look, this is garbage. This is garbage science basing it on epidemiologic studies. It's just completely ridiculous. Gordon Guyatt, who is the guy, literally the guy who invented the term evidence-based medicine back in 1991, he's up at Masters University in Canada. He basically, in 2019, was the lead author on a huge review of red meat called the Nutrirex Consortium, where 14 scientists from around the world basically said, there is no strong evidence to suggest that red meat is causing cancer, heart disease, or any other disease, or impacting mortality. Just keep eating it like you are. And that prompted the Physicians Committee on Responsible Medicine to petition the FTC to retract those studies that were published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And so we've got a lot of pushback from those sort of things. But I mean, even like I said, even if we assume that the World Health Organization's proclamation in 2015 was true, that it slightly increases your risk for colorectal cancer, you think about what else causes colorectal cancer, is associated with colorectal cancer. And you would look at things like obesity clearly increases your risk. Diabetes increases your risk. What really increases your risk is inflammatory bowel disease. That's not like a 17% increase. That's like a 3,000% increased risk factor. So if you have active Crohn's disease, active ulcerative colitis, you have a 3,000-fold, or you know, like a 300, you know, like it's like a 30-fold or a 3,000% increased likelihood of developing this disease. And what happens to people when they go on a carnivore diet? They get leaner. Their diabetes goes away. Their inflammation goes down. Their Crohn's disease goes into remission. So you're saying, well, I've got like 4,000% increase over here with the cumulative risk factors versus 17% here. So it's like, okay, how do I, anybody that does basic math can say that. They can say, well, if I have $100 in this pot and one penny over here, I'm going to go with $100, right? I mean, it's just, you can look at risk factors that way. So yeah, so there's that sort of matrix you can jump down.
Hey folks, are you ready to take control of your health and feel your best? At Avantia Health Optimization, which is my health coaching company, we get that everyone is different. So we tailor our coaching programs just for you. Meaning we're not just handing you some cookie cutter program. We're not giving you some documents and saying, hey, just here, go do this on your own. No, we listen to your goals. We hear what you're trying to accomplish. We learn about your habits and routines and time management and approaches and everything in between, and it is completely tailored to you. So if you're dealing with stress, sleep issues, weight loss, changing your diet, being consistent with exercise, or if you just want to feel more vibrant and awake, our health coaches are here to help. Now, for a limited time, you can try our health coaching for just $1. Yes, your first health coaching session is just $1. It's a great way to see how personalized health coaching can make a real difference in your life. And it is just $1 because I know a lot of people have never tried health coaching. They don't really know what it's all about. A lot of people still think that I'm a personal trainer, which is not at all what I do as a health coach. So if you want some proof about how we've helped people, you can check out the testimonials on our website from clients who have already transformed their health with us. Head over to AvantiaHealthOptimization.com, or if it's easier, you can go to MikeVera.com. That's Mike, V as in Victor, E-R-A.com, to learn more and snag your $1 first session today. So let's get started on your journey to a healthier, more awake you with Avantia Health Optimization. Now back to the show. Well, it does seem pretty clear. I mean, when you look at people's experiences, when you look at the case that you make, when you look at a lot of the evidence that is coming out now, that there's good reason to at least try carnivore diet even for a short period of time, or at least to not avoid meat like it's the plague. But there is still this growing pushback against meat consumption. I know you mentioned Bill Gates is funding a lot of it. And I do want to be clear before I finish my question here. A lot of these are kind of playing devil's advocate. They come from a place of healthy sense of skepticism. But, you know, I'm in carnivore diet now, as I mentioned. But we also know, so there's this vegan propaganda coming from Bill Gates. You see it on Netflix documentaries. We also know the beef lobby is pretty big too. And I wonder how you think that might play a role in the confusion around all of this, because I would imagine they are putting some propaganda out there, and propaganda on either side, whether it's from the beef industry, whether it's from vegans, that can make things confusing. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there is a lot of confusion out there, and I don't think that's going to ever stop. I mean, people are going to lobby for what's in their financial interest. I mean, that's going to clearly occur. So, I mean, again, it comes down to you to assess what's important to you. And I think that's the way I would look at that. So, I mean, again, the one thing that you have that you can assess probably better than anybody else is your own health. I mean, that's something to see. So if you're 100 pounds overweight and you go on a carnivore diet and you lose 100 pounds, that's arguably a good thing. I mean, some people, well, you can go on heroin and cocaine and do that. But I mean, that's obviously there's some differences there. I think that when it comes to propaganda, I mean, if you look at some of the motivations, I mean, like I said, one thing we know is that whenever we remove animal foods from the diet or cut back on that, it is almost invariably replaced with ultra processed stuff. I mean, that's just what happens. I mean, you look at the studies on people that consume a more plant-based diet, whether it's vegan, vegetarian, or flexitarian, it clearly directly shows an increase in the consumption of ultra-processed foods. And what's nice about ultra-processed foods, I'm being facetious here, is they make more money. They're more profitable. And so the corporations would rather us just eat more ultra-processed food because they make more money with that. There's a higher ROI on that. Whereas meat, I mean, it's very expensive. I mean, it takes like 3 years to produce a steak. I mean, it's like the cow has to get pregnant, a 9-month gestation period, then they got to grow it and feed it for 2 years before they can slaughter it. It's a lot of money and effort and time, whereas they can grind up some soybeans and mix it up with some stuff and stick it on the shelf for 10 years, and it's still there. So it's a much more profitable avenue in the food production thing. So there is these pushes to say that, look, you don't have to go vegan, but just give up your meat on Mondays. Just do meatless Mondays. Because you're right, the meat industry is about a $1.5 trillion worldwide. The meat industry is like $1.5 trillion. I think the beef industry worldwide is something like $600 billion. So it's a lot of money, right? It's a lot of money. But if you can capture one day a week, that's 14%. You get 14% of $1.5 trillion, that's $100 billion or something like that. So it's not an insignificant amount of money that people will be willing to. We see what people do. And people kill, they'll kill you for $100. And so what do you think somebody's going to do for $100 billion? So you see a lot of shady, shifty things going on around there. So again, it comes down to you to assess your own stuff. And like I said, don't believe me. I don't care if you think whether you think I have credibility or not. I would tell people, assess for themselves. If you go and just go on a carnivore diet of your own accord, it doesn't benefit me in any way. I mean, I'm not getting paid for that. I mean, I could care less. I hope it gets you healthy is all I could say. I like to see it benefits me in that we have a healthier society. I'd like to see my kids grow up in a world where not one in every four person has some mental health disorder. That's a real problem. So if we can fix that through nutrition, that would be great. And I think that this is what, again, I can only go by my experience. Historically, I'm quite a skeptical person. I'm quite conservative in my thought in many ways. I mean, one of my earliest jobs was I used to launch nuclear bombs for the U.S. Air Force. I mean, I was one of the guys that sat down in the silo with my hand on the key, like turn the key, blow up the world, right? They don't let wackos in that job. They don't let people that are like unstable. So I'm very sort of personality-wise, kind of conservative. I'm very stable in my thought. And but how did I adopt this such a wacky position on nutrition? The only reason I see that is because what I have seen has been so convincing to me that I felt it was worth sharing. I mean, I've seen just over, by the thousandth time I saw somebody put their diabetes in remission, I'm like, there's something here, guys. We need to talk about this. And so this is why I've been such a vocal proponent of this so-called crazy restrictive eating disorder diet that some people like to characterize it as.
I mean, if you like steak, it's a great diet. It's perfect for me because not only do I like steak, but I honestly hate vegetables. So
yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, I never liked vegetables as a kid. I mean, I can remember sitting many a night staring at a freaking cold plate of broccoli going, damn it, man. And my parents were like, eat it, kid. You're not going anywhere. And I'd choke it down. But I mean, sometimes I'd be there for like 3 hours. Like, yeah, I never liked them. I think there's an inherent reason why that is. I think that's why. I mean, most little kids, you see little babies, you see it all the time. You give the baby their first thing, a stewed broccoli or whatever, carrots or whatever, usually broccoli. And they're like, and they smack it across their little play table. And but you give them a ribeye, they're like, ah, I'm happy. Give me some more of that. So it's interesting. Some people make the argument, well, the baby will eat sugar too. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think we're wired for energy. I mean, we're seeking energy and there's not much energy in plants. Like I said, it is a low yield product. I mean, think about if I were in the wild, you and I were in the wild, we're starving to death and there's an animal and maybe there's some fruit and there's some leaves. The last thing we're eating is leaves, right? The berry's going to run out. We're not going to be able to get many of those. We're not going to get many calories. It's going to make a lot of work. We kill a big, fat, juicy animal and now we're eating like kings for a week maybe or something like that. So I think that's kind of what we're wired to in many ways.
Well, taking a little bit of a shift here, I know you've talked about the now kind of famous Oreo study. And the results kind of seem to indicate that having high cholesterol doesn't automatically indicate poor health. And I'd like to hear a little bit, I know you've talked about this before, but I guess to me, it seemed comparable to what doctors used to say, where they used to say, well, having elevated ketones is harmful because that is evidence of ketoacidosis. But now we know with people doing the ketogenic diet, having elevated ketones could also be a sign of a healthy lifestyle as long as they're doing it in a healthy way. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
Yeah, in some instances. I mean, I think Nick Norwich, a friend of mine who's done this, he's an Oxford PhD, he's now finishing his MD up at Harvard. I talk to Nick all the time about some of this stuff, and he's one of the guys that we're trying to get some research with. That wasn't really that experiment, this Oreo cookie experiment, was not a commentary on whether high cholesterol was healthy or not. It was just explaining why it was there. It was explaining the so-called lipid energy model. And so the model goes like this. It says that if you are in a low-carb state, you're going to have reduced stores of energy on your body, particularly glycogen. It's going to be lower. And if you're lean, like Nick is, Nick's a very lean guy. He's probably BMI of like 20 or something like that, quite lean. Then when your cells are hungry, like they need energy, like you're exercising, your cells need energy, and you don't have glucose, a lot of extra glucose around, they're gonna request energy, and your liver is gonna provide it to them in the forms of fat. So that increases the flux of fat in the system. It's just like you're trafficking fat to get to the cells that need it. And so by doing that, the cholesterol is gonna go up because it's part of that trafficking system. And so that's just demonstrating. So by eating, what he was doing is saying, I'm going to do something really goofy and over the top so I can get a lot of eyes on this because I want to do something outrageous. So I'm going to eat Oreo cookies, which all of us would agree are probably not good for us. I mean, eating a diet of Oreo cookies would probably be, it might be fun for a while, but it would probably be a fast track to obesity and food addiction and gut issues and God knows what else.
Well, the Oreos are vegan.
Yeah, I think they are. Some of them are. I think there's certain brands that are vegan. And because Oreos, apparently, Nick taught me there's like all kinds of different Oreo varieties now. There's like 20 different varieties. But so But most of us would recognize Oreo cookies as not, certainly not a health food, right? So he was like, well, I bet I can bring my cholesterol down because of this lipid energy model as I restore my liver glycogen by consuming carbohydrates. And he did 12 a day, which worked out to 100 grams of carbs. He said, I think at 100 grams of carbs, and it could have come from fruit, it could have come from rice, but he said, I'm just going to do it out of Oreos because just out of spite. And he compared that to taking a statin. And he normally, as a quote unquote, a lean mass hyperresponder, has very high cholesterol normally at baseline. You were talking LDL cholesterol, 300, 400, something like that. And with the Oreo cookie, it dropped precipitously, dropped down like almost like 300 points, as I recall, maybe 280 points. And he did that for like 3 weeks. And then he said, okay, now I'm going to go back to my normal state. I'm going to go back to my normal diet, get my cholesterol back up high again. And now I'm going to try a statin and see what happens. And he went on a high dose statin, and guess what? It came down, but just a little bit. So the Oreo cookie was more effective at lowering his LDL cholesterol than was his statin. And so that sort of supports the lipid energy model. He made the hypothesis, I think, because this lipid energy model would predict that my cholesterol would drop when I eat carbs. And that's been shown a number of times. And what's interesting, like Adrian Sotomoda, who's one of Nick's buddies and also another Oxford PhD that trained in Harvard, spent time in Harvard, did an analysis, a randomized controlled trial meta-analysis of 41 randomized controlled trials looking at low-carb diets that reported cholesterol findings. And what he found was the number one predictive factor for raising your LDL cholesterol in a low-carb setting was basically how lean you got, right? So it wasn't how much saturated fat you ate or any of that stuff. It was just how lean you got. So most people would say, well, being lean is generally healthy, right? Outside of anorexia or some drug addiction. But generally, we associate leanness with health and obesity with lack of health, right? So then the question becomes, well, if getting lean is making my cholesterol go up, in that situation, is high cholesterol bad? And the answer to that is, we don't really know yet. I mean, there's some data out there that would suggest it's not. I mean, it's emerging and we're getting more studies on it. But so I think that's the whole point, is bringing attention to this phenomenon that there are people for which LDL cholesterol goes up quite high. And importantly, ApoB will go up higher, total cholesterol, they all move in the same direction. So any metric you want to use to say, this is driving heart disease, you can say, well, maybe it's the reason it's high, not so much the fact that it is high. Like, the other reason it might be high is, like, let's just say the opposite is true. Let's say you're obese and your cells are stuffed with energy. Your liver's like overflowing with glycogen. And it's a fatty liver and you got fat and all over, all your cells are full of fat. Then when you're eating, well, it's not that the liver needs to pump out energy. It's just that the cholesterol in your blood, it's like, I don't really need to go anywhere. There's nothing driving it. So it's just sitting there in the blood, like the blood glucose is just sitting there in the blood because the cells are already stuffed full and they're resistant to taking any more on. And so you have that energy accumulating in the blood, but for a very different reason. And most people argue that a fat couch potato with pre-diabetic or diabetic with high cholesterol is a problem, right? So in those people, you're like, let's fix stuff. And so the easiest thing to do is like, well, we can stick you on a pill and we can lower that cholesterol. That's knocking down one of those risk factors. Are we going to work on those other issues, which we probably should? Most of the time we don't, because we're lazy as physicians. We're like, yeah, let's put you on some drugs. At least we've masked some of these risk factors, but it's not addressing the root cause of the problem, in my view.
So how would that connect to this other story that you may have seen circulating? This was a big headline. Harvard student eats 700 eggs in a month.
Yeah.
And his cholesterol levels dropped to, I believe, healthy levels.
So, well, they dropped by 20. It's the same. It's Nick's the same guy. He's doing all, he did bacon. He did 600 strips of bacon. So he just keeps doing the same outrageous experiments to show this thing. And it's the exact same scenario. He's like, well, cholesterol has a lot of, eggs have a lot of cholesterol and we're demonizing cholesterol. And what happens if I eat just a massive amount of cholesterol over a period of time? And again, if you look in the subtlety of that paper, I think that I'll have to look into the thing. I think he started adding carbs in again and dropped his cholesterol. I think that was the effect on there. And there's been a few studies over the years looking. There's an old paper on a guy that ate 25 eggs every day. He was like an old nursing home patient and his cholesterol was low. And people were like, well, how the hell is that possible? They said he had some sort of mental health disorder. We only ate eggs. He was kind of crazy, but his cholesterol was low. So yeah, I mean, it's the same guy doing the same sort of experiment, showing the same thing. He did the same thing with bacon recently. He did 600 strips of bacon in a month. I think he said he had like 70,000 calories of bacon over a month. And again, his cholesterol didn't go up or went down or something similar. So it's, again, it's showing that the driver for high cholesterol, again, in the low carb setting, is not the amount of saturated fat or cholesterol you eat. It is more to do with how lean you are. Now, if you're a vegan and you don't eat any fat, and then you add a bunch of eggs and bacon in there, yeah, your cholesterol is going to go up a little bit. But I guess it depends on where your set point is and what's driving it there. But I mean, yeah, I mean, he's just doing these little metabolic experiments in the most outrageous, ridiculous way, just to draw attention to it.
Hey folks, just a quick pause on our discussion today because I have something important to share. You know that I'm always in front of screens, and that artificial light can be disruptive to the circadian rhythm, and that can impact your health pretty severely. So that's why I wear Boncharge blue light blocking glasses. It's not just a stylish accessory, but it's really a daily defense against eye strain, headaches, disrupted sleep schedules, and really that circadian rhythm that I'm trying to protect. So it does protect your eyes. It does improve your sleep. It does help maintain your circadian health. And honestly, I've experienced fewer headaches and just a better overall sense of my health. I feel healthier when I wear these. And yeah, they do look cool as well. I get compliments all the time, especially when I wear them out at a restaurant or something like that. So for those who are looking to boost their health in this digital age, I've got some good news. As part of the Healthy and Awake community, you can get 15% off by going to the show notes, clicking the affiliate link, and using the coupon code Healthy and Awake with dashes. So that's Healthy dash and dash awake. And you can get 15% off of these very cool Boncharge blue light blocking glasses. And that's a great way to enhance your daily health routine and your style. Now let's dive back into the episode.
And I think that's, I mean, he's very social media savvy on that. He wants to be the next Andrew Huberman type of guy where he can just sit there, because that's kind of interesting. He's finishing up his medical degree. And I talked to Nick and I said, he was thinking about becoming a pediatrician. And then he said, I think I'm just going to go straight into being the social media guy. So I think that's what he's doing. So I mean, he's a bright guy. I mean, he's got a PhD for heart. He still do research and stuff, but I don't think he's going to practice medicine, which some people would argue, well, why the hell do we train you if you're not going to practice? Why do we spend all those resources on you? Because you're taking somebody else's slot away. But again, it's like, it's an interesting sort of argument there.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. And I see we only have about 20 minutes left. I have so many questions I could tell we're not going to get to. So I just want to tell my audience, definitely get the book, because a lot of the stuff that I did want to ask, I know is covered in the book. You'll get a lot of answers there.
Yep.
So I want to get to something perhaps a little juicier. I saw a clip of an NYU professor. I think this was a TED Talk. He suggests actually inducing meat allergies with some sort of meat patches, kind of like the Lone Star tick, like you're right, manufacturing right. The Lone Star tick and putting right. It on people to supposedly improve conditions of the planet. I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I think like most people here think that's absolutely nuts. I mean, there's people that strongly believe in the narrative that cattle in particular are causing climate change, and it's going to cause global catastrophe, and all these people are going to die from either global warming or sea levels rising and something like that. But I mean, the research doesn't really support that. Even some of the most ardent climate change, I wouldn't call them activists, but scientists like a guy like Michael Mann. I mean, he's a big guy that talks about climate change, wrote this hockey stick book. He basically says, no, cows aren't really the problem. That's not really the issue. It's fossil fuels and so on and so forth. So depending on where you fall, I know there's people out say the climate change is a big hoax and it's all just a scam to get to, so the government can take away more freedoms and so on and so forth. Wherever you fall on that spectrum, I don't think cows are really the major issue that they're made out to be. Now, the people that want to sell you fake meat, the vegan activists are going to really push that message. Because that's either they're ideologically opposed to animal agriculture, or they stand to make a lot of money from that. So we see a lot of that. But I mean, like I said, it's like, I think he's the same guy that was proposing that we like shrink humans. Like we genetically alter people to be smaller, so they have a smaller footprint. Because bigger, like I'm a big guy, I eat more. I eat more than little people. I mean, that's just the way it is. But I mean, maybe I shouldn't be allowed to exist, because maybe anybody that's like parents over 6 foot shouldn't be allowed to reproduce or something like that. You could, it's dystopian. It's just crazy. Yeah, but I mean, there is something. There's this Lone Star tick. And it's not, and by the way, that's not the only tick that can induce this so-called alpha-gal allergy, where you have an allergy to mammalian meat, you have a reaction. Some people will have a long-term severe reaction. Most people, it's mild and it's temporary. But yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of craziness that's out there that's being talked about this. And there's people out there that are like, it's like cow farts are destroying the, or cows are destroying the environment. And then you say, well, cows are the environment in many ways. I mean, this is part of the natural ecosystem that's been around forever. I mean, we've had, I mean, you can go back to the North American plains where we had up to maybe 90 million bison roaming the plains from down from Mexico all up into Canada. And there was no climate change then. There, if you go back to the time of the last sort of ice age time, right before that, we had way more megafaunal animals. I mean, we had these huge amounts of like elephants and mastodons and mammoths and all these giant animals that were all out there burping and farting all this methane. And we were in an ice age. I mean, it's just like, it's not the driver. It's biogenic amine or cyclic amine, sorry, methane. Biogenic methane is very different from what's going on with fossil fuels. So, I mean, even if you make the argument that climate change is there, the methane, Frank Mitlaner at UC Davis has done some great work on this. He's talked about this extensively. He's been, of course, attacked over you're funded by the meat industry or something like that, which is, you know, largely not true. But he puts out the point that, I mean, this is a cycle. I mean, methane, yes, cow burps end up in methane and it goes up in the atmosphere and it has an impact, but then it's altered in the atmosphere at a very rapid rate and returned back to feed the plants. It's just like, this is a cycle that's part of nature that's been around forever. And to suggest that that is somehow destroying the planet is just wrong. And I think more and more people are starting to realize this. I think we've had the sort of era of plant-based, and you can see what's happened with all these kind of fake meat companies that have gone on, Beyond Meat, Impossible Burger, Corn, all these companies are failing because no one's buying it. And they certainly don't want the ultra-processed crap. And then even the fake meat lab meats that these startups are coming, they're really struggling now. They're really finding that, hey, they're not paying off. The Silicon Valley guys that have invested tens of billions of dollars in these companies are not getting their money out of it. So they're like gun shy. They're like, well, we're going to leave that stuff alone. So I think it's the wrong way to go.
Yeah, and I know they're investing a lot of money into getting people to want to eat bugs as well. But on the climate issue, for anyone who wants to take a deeper dive into that, on episode 43 of Healthy and Awake podcast, I spoke with Dr. Judith Curry, who is a world-leading expert on climate science. I asked her a similar question. She said, one of the worst things you can do is mess with the food. So you can take a deeper dive there if you want. I heard you speak about Ozempic, and you really blew my mind with some of your takes. I remember you saying something like meat naturally slows down digestion, which is what people who take Ozempic are trying to accomplish. And even worse, if somebody is on Ozempic and their digestion is slowed down and they decide to eat sweets, well, those are supposed to be processed fast and you're kind of throwing a wrench into the metabolic process there. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, in general, yeah. I mean, like I said, I don't think the solution to the obesity epidemic, I don't think the solution for the chronic disease epidemic is going to be more drugs. I mean, I just don't think. And again, you think about how these drugs are manufactured and designed. They are designed to be taken for the rest of your life. I mean, this is a pharmaceutical model. It's not to cure disease. It's not to eradicate disease or decrease the incidence. It's just to keep more people medicated chronically for the rest of their life for recurring revenue. And so this is Ozempic's another one. And I know there's physician champions and people jumping up and down because they're seeing some people lose some weight on this for the first time in maybe many, many years. And undoubtedly, there's going to be some people that will lose weight with this. Some of them will be able to keep it off. I think the majority, if you do not address the underlying issue, the addictive issues, the overall nutrition quality, it's not going to work long term, I think, for most people. I think some of the problems with the drug, like you mentioned, it's a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so what is GLP-1? GLP-1 is an incretin hormone, which is, it modulates our gut function, right? And so the way it normally works in our body, so GLP-1 is secreted by something called the L cell, like the letter L in the ileum, which is the end of our small intestine. What happens is normally, and there's this concept called the ileal break. And what happens is as nutrition sort of winds its way through the intestine and gets to the very end, and these cells start sensing nutrition, if there's too much, they say, wait a minute, this nutrition is not getting absorbed. Slow things down so we can start absorbing everything. And meat, it's particularly potent. Beef isolate very potently stimulates GLP-1 because when we eat a steak, our gut does slow down because we want to absorb all that nutrition. You think about it. When's the last time you saw a hunk of meat floating in the toilet? This doesn't occur, right? Never, because it's all absorbed. Now you contrast that to fibrous vegetables. Yeah, I mean, corn, and I mean, it's kind of gross, but you see this stuff in your feces. So but GLP-1 is supposed to hang around for about 5 minutes. It's supposed to be, it stimulates, it does its job, slows things down, and it goes away. When you take the injections, it hangs around in your body for days and days on end. So that's why people have these side effects of intestinal obstructions, gastroparesis. Sometimes it's gut paralysis of the stomach. Sometimes that's permanent for some people. And then, like I said, a lot of people will say they have these awful burps because they got this food that's sitting in their gut and just rotting in their stomach. It's not getting passed through. And it's just like there's a dead animal inside them. It's like awful. So we get some of these side effects. The other thing around that is there's some evidence that it leads to what's called fat cell hyperplasia, which means that your fat cells get smaller, but there's more of them. And so as long as you're on the drug, you keep these small fat cells. But guess what happens when you go off the drug? Now you have more fat cells than you started with. And so you'll start seeing more and more weight gain. And so I think what we'll see, and this is what I would, again, I've mentioned this before, when I was training to be a doctor and a surgeon, one of the guys said, never be the first guy. Don't be the first guy to jump on a trend because you're going to get burned. Don't be the last guy, but don't be the first guy. And I think a lot of these people, these early adopters of this, yeah, there's a lot of people wanting this. They can make a lot of money. It's a quick buck. You can make a quick buck. Open a little Ozempic clinic and you can make $1 million in a year and yeah, life is good. But the problem with that is, you know, you're going to start seeing probably, my prediction is probably, I don't know, 5-10 years from now, those drugs will no longer be in vogue. There'll be too many side effects. There's already class action lawsuits that are developing that they're going to sue. Let's say it's a super wonderful drug that from the pharmaceutical standpoint, and they sell it to 700 million people, 1/10 of the Earth's population goes on this drug. That would be like the pharmaceutical's wet dream. Probably of that 700 million people, there's probably going to be 1 million or more people that are going to have like significant, serious complications like thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer, gut paralysis, bowel obstruction, suicide, things like that. And they'll we'll pay a $4 billion fine, $5 billion fine. They take it out of their change drawer. That's already built into the cost of doing business there. Because this drug will sell $500 billion, maybe $1 trillion when it's all said and done. Maybe it'll get pulled from the market, maybe it'll fall out of vogue, but then it'll be onto the next drug by then. It'll be onto the next iteration. Maybe it'll do some gene editing or whatever. We're going to go to that. But again, ultimately, I just don't think that's a solution. I just don't think you can fix a nutrition problem without fixing the nutrition. And I think that's really where we're at.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thalidomide and Vioxx come to mind, where that seems to be the pharmaceutical industry's MO, where they'll put out drugs. The population is the guinea pig. When they find out there's problems, then they pay out basically.
Yeah, I mean, as an orthopedic surgeon, I prescribed Vioxx quite a bit when I was, early in my career, it was a good drug. I mean, it worked well for like knee pain. I mean, I can remember like patients really did well with that. The only problem with that was that 100,000 people died of heart disease from that. And not only that, the company knew that ahead of time. They like knew this. And that was only because it was criminal. It wasn't just fraud, but it was criminal negligence or something. And they still, what do? They paid a fine. No one went to jail. No one got fired. I mean, it's ridiculous that we live in a society where you can literally kill 100,000 people and your company pays a fine for you. I mean, it's just insane.
It really is. I'm actually going to try to reach out to some notable vegans next. I'm going to reach out to actually Dr. Joel Kahn. What are some questions you think I should ask whoever I talk to?
Oh gosh, Joel. I've talked to Joel many times. He's kind of a funny guy. I actually like Joel. I don't dislike any particular vegans. I think some of them are wacky and crazy, but I think that I would say that we know, for instance, that vegan diets are associated with increased fracture rates. I mean, Joel himself broke his foot stepping off of an escalator. I was like, oh, the escalator attacked me. Oh, yes, you're Joel. Yeah. So he himself is seeing some of the consequences of that are just playing out in real time in his own life. We know that there's clear issues with requiring supplementation, particularly around B12, and there's other ones. Like Joel is now taking things like, I think, taurine and some of these other, he supplements quite heavily, quite honestly. He's got all these supplements he's taking. And I'm just like, well, maybe your diet is not like all it's cracked out to be if you have to take all these supplements. And these are a lot of animal-based supplements, carnitine, carnosine, taurine, on and on. I know the last thing I saw him talking about spermidine. He's like, which is initially was found in sperm, which is kind of you can make a joke about that. But I mean, I think that, I mean, I lectured, I didn't like, I mean, I, yeah, I was giving a presentation at, it was called Paleo Effects several years ago. It was like 6 or 7 years ago. Joel was sitting next to me And I remember specifically a patient from the audience came up and said, Dr. Khan, I did your plant-based diet for years and it wrecked my health. And now I'm doing a carnivore diet and I'm so much better. So, I mean, just ask them how they explain that there are vegans that clear. I mean, I've seen thousands upon thousands of ex-vegans, plant-based diets, vegetarians that will go to a carnivore diet and their health will get remarkably better. How does he account for that? And he'll say, well, I mean, I don't know. He'll say why they were sick on it. Maybe they did the vegan diet wrong. That's always often the excuse. And then why they got better on a meat-based diet. Well, maybe it's temporary and they're going to die of heart disease. And I'm a cardiologist and I see it in my clinic all the time. And I would argue, I would posit, Joel, I don't think he sees a lot of carnivores in his clinic. I think he sees a lot of meat eaters that are eating a standard Western diet. But I mean, again, does he? Okay, let me ask you, the average American diet is plant-based. It's about 70% plant-based right now. Just that fact alone. Now, you would argue, well, some of it's ultra-processed garbage. Yeah, that's true. But it's still plant-based. And we can, and they will be very quick to point out that, oh, that's not a whole food diet. That's not a whole food plant-based diet. A whole food plant-based diet is very different. I would say, and I had Garth Davis, who's another vegan, basically agree to this. I said, Garth, what if we had a whole food meat-based diet, like a healthy meat index, where we'd say these are, yes, we can say that Stouffer's lasagna is not a really good place to get meat. Let's say Slim Jim beef jerky sticks with all kinds of garbage is not a healthy meat. What if we said whole cuts of meat, whole unprocessed or minimally processed, whole ingredient, single ingredient meat, would that satisfy the criteria of a healthy meat-based diet? And do we have data on that we could compare to? We don't. I'll just tell you, we don't have data on that. We need data on that. I'm trying to get studies on that. That's what I'm always working behind the scenes, trying to get people to fund studies and get organizations to study that. We've been making some inroad on that. But, you know, Joel is often, he's always chastised, where's the science? Show me the science. I'm like, Joel, man, I'm trying to get it done. It's like, there's not a lot of money. I mean, they've got the advantage. You know, veganism started in 1944, I believe. There was a British guy that coined the term veganism. It wasn't even humanly possible until they figured out the right supplementations they could do. But since that time, so this has been going on for now, that's 1944, it's 80 years. They've been an 80-year head start. The Adventist Help Group is a multi-billion dollar organization. They fund plant-based science studies. The Physicians College of Lifestyle, or the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, another multi-million dollar operation, which funds plant-based studies. Emil Bernard and his Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, also multi-million dollar. PETA, animal rights organization, which has lots of money, funds these studies. So when you start saying, oh, look, we've got all these studies, well, it's like, that's only because you've had the money to fund it. We don't have that money on the carnivore side yet. Even the beef industry, which I've gone to and said, hey, guys, let's fund some carnivore studies. They were very reluctant and they have not funded anything. They don't want to. I talked to their head dietitian, who's a registered dietitian that's like standard omnivore. Well, I don't believe in carnivore diets. So she just basically demurred and said, I'm not going to do it. Only now, literally right now as we speak, I think we're going to get a study finally funded on diabetes, an intervention trial, which I think we sorely need. So I think that, I mean, you can point to the science and the other place. Well, there's two types of cardiologists out there, the ones that have read the vegan literature and the ones that have, this is what they'll say to justify their vegan diet. The other thing I would say is, if you put it all in terms of lowering your cholesterol and decreasing your risk for cardiovascular disease, are there anything other considerations of lifestyle that matter? I mean, does it matter that someone who has intractable depression or Crohn's disease, where they're crapping their pants with bloody diarrhea 20 times a day, now by going carnivore, gets back to a normal life? Is that important? I mean, because I think patients have choice. And I don't think you can sit there and say, oh, well, you shouldn't do this diet because I think your risk for heart disease may go up by 20% over a period of 50 years. I don't know. I mean, I think you should let the patients make that decision. And I think that, I think as a physician, I think anytime you start predicting the future, like I think this is going to cause you to have this in 20 years, your accuracy goes way, way down, right? But if I can take a patient that's sick and suffering in front of me right now, today, and I can say, hey, look, I think in 6 weeks we can get you better, or 6 months or whatever it is, that to me is more valuable as a physician, because everything else is just purely speculative. And I would say, what is the best data, you know, that you would hang your hat on, that you would be willing to bet all your household income on? And I would not make that bet giving something, trying to make a prediction 50 years down the road. And I just think that's a very dangerous bet.
Wow. Well, one thing that really stood out to me there, I mentioned at the beginning that I'm a health coach and they push for us to really preach the plant-based diet. The American College of Lifestyle Medicine is really what drives that. And I didn't know that they were kind of betting on a plant-based diet by putting millions of dollars into funding that research. So that really stood out to me there. But I know we're at time. Dr. Sean Baker, thank you so much. Where can people find out more about you?
Well, so I've got a lot of social media. I'm Sean Baker MD on YouTube. I'm Sean Baker MD on TikTok. I am Sean Baker 1967 on Instagram. I am S Baker MD on X, formerly Twitter. Rivero.com is our company, where we are a digital health company licensed in all 50 states. We just take people in and we fix their nutrition and provide all kinds of support for them. We have health coaching and tech support and all kinds of education material. And I do meetings with those patients all the time. And so those are the major places. I still do some one-on-one consultations. I've got a little practice where I still like interaction with people. So I do a little bit of that. Any of my websites, any of my social media will have a link for that too as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, folks. Stay healthy, stay awake.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake, or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy, stay awake.